Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. And this morning, we are going to head to Westport to check in with First Selectman Jim Marpy. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I wish I could say that I was feeling great and all that, but of course I can't. And you've been talking about it for all morning on your show, and this is just a time when the town of Westport is still reeling from the murder-suicide that you've been reporting on. I can't really go into any more details than you've already reported in terms of the investigation, but I can tell you everywhere I was this weekend, people were reacting baffled, difficult wrapping their heads around this. We've talked about this. I have a daughter more or less your age who's a mother of my six-month-old grandson. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to her about this last week, she could not wrap her head around this, and I think you were talking about that yourself earlier as well.
Yeah, it just physically makes you sick, and of course, it's not, to press judgment. Obviously, this is a very private matter. This was something that court documents has shown. There was obviously some lingering issues between the mother and father in this case, and I know you can't really speak on the case, nor would I ask you to. But I think it's this idea of a seven-year-old. The seven-year-old is really, I think, what's making people physically sick about this case this morning. And my understanding, Jim, is that this is the first homicide investigation Westport has seen in years, correct?
That's right. It's been nearly a decade since we last had a homicide. And to your point, I'm no expert in this, but I think most homicides have an obvious reason. It's a robbery. It's a gang activity. It's clear-cut domestic violence, what have you, none of which is good. But in this case, a seven-year-old child, getting through that is difficult enough. And I kind of want to talk about today is how we as a town have been organized, fortunately or unfortunately as the case may be, prepared to deal with things like this. You know, the particularly the students at Coley Town Elementary School where the 7-year-old was attending. You know, this has been a tough enough year and a half for students in any of the schools with COVID, and literally the last day of school, which was meant to be a happy day, and so has been totally disrupted. My hat's off to the school administration and the PTA for trying to organize a couple of small, quiet events out of the sight of the media to try and help the kids get through that. And I really have to give credit to School Superintendent Tom Scarese and his staff. Thursday afternoon, within minutes of knowing that this had happened, they swung into action, organized counseling and support. Sadly, we're prepared for tragedies like this, but in the background of the Staples High School in-person graduation, our superintendent and his team having to deal with preparing for that. So all credit to them. The other part there's a couple other parts here that get missed occasionally. You know, our police who had to respond to the scene. This was a pretty grisly scene, as best I understand it. They fortunately, again, we have in place counseling for our first responders, and that kicked in Thursday evening. So there was immediate counseling. And I talked to one of the counselors Friday when I was over at the police station, and he didn't give me any specific details, but he's been at this for 25 years, and he talked about 25 years ago when he would be working with police on something like this, they'd just sort of sit there with their arms crossed and didn't want to talk about anything. Tough guys.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and we're talking to First Selectman Jim Marpy of Westport this morning. And I'm glad you touched on that, Jim, because that was what I was going to actually talk about. Was I know that the schools immediately stepped up and said, listen, any faculty, staff, students, family members, parents of these kids, if you need any services, we knew that those were made available immediately. We knew two of the schools actually didn't even have classes on Friday because we knew Layla went to school in your district. But that was going to be my my question was, when you see something like this case for our first responders, I think sometimes unless you live that life, you can't really relate to what those first responders saw. And that was going to be my question was, you know, how do we secure our police, our medics, our first responders to seeing something like that and still putting a uniform on this morning and getting back to their job?
Yeah. Now, to all the credit to our police chief, Jorge Cosquinas, and the people who work for him, we were prepared to deal with this and to provide the counseling for our police officers and our EMS team that had to respond. I also want to talk about, though, on a townwide basis, where we've a little over 2 years ago, before the pandemic, everything else, I asked my select woman, Jen Tooker, to work with our human services director, Elaine Danow, to put together some prevention and counseling capabilities to kind of pull it together for the entire town. And they put together back in 2019 something called Westport Together, and that's an alliance between the town, the schools, and our local nonprofits. And the focus was primarily on youth, but it was also to strengthen the health and well-being and the access to organizations that offer support in the mental health arena. So after last week, the website, which is www.westporttogether.org, it's proving to be a great resource for anybody in the community who's looking to find out more about where do you get help around suicide, counseling of any kind, whether it's domestic violence, just help with behavioral problems. Mm-hmm. WestportTogether.org or on Facebook and Instagram. I really recommend it.
Well, First Selectman Jim Marpy, we appreciate you coming on, even just touching on such a tragic event. Certainly praying for Westport, praying for the father in this situation, the family members, the loved ones. Thank you so much for coming on this morning. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, thank you, Melissa. And it's a difficult thing to deal with, but we're a caring community, and I know with prayers like yours and all of our residents, we will get through this.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate that.
Lieutenant Jim Perez, Fairfield Police Department. Crime on the mind. Melissa in the morning. WICC 600.
So as long as the governor signs it, which we are positive he's going to do that because he has said it multiple times, a week from Thursday, it is going to be legal to possess marijuana here in Connecticut. And I think one of the biggest concerns, Lieutenant Perez, from a lot of our listeners and from even people who oppose the legislation is driving high. I think that continues to be one of the biggest concerns with that. So I was curious if you could talk a little bit about this morning. First of all, how can officers even detect if a driver is high behind the wheel?
Well, we have officers that are state trained and really are kind of like almost like drug recognition experts that can actually do a series of tests if we determine that someone's under the influence. If it's not under the general routine DUI methods that we use to detect whether someone has an elevated alcohol blood content. With drugs, it's going to be a little bit different, but there are I suppose, practices out there which we can kind of adopt to be able to detect, even on the street, whether someone is under the influence. So there's DUI and there's there's driving under the influence and DWI. So we can stop someone currently now if we suspect that they're on some type of medication or other drug or drugs other than alcohol. So,
but there's no like breathalyzer, right, Lieutenant Perez? Like that was the big controversy, is differently than alcohol. There's no like breathalyzer tool to determine that, right?
Yeah, well, I think the industry is working now on developing as more, you know, we're not the first state that's going to legalize it, right? There's over 13 states or 14 states. So, I mean, but it's still, marijuana will still be illegal under the federal law. So, so it's still considered a scheduled drug. So, but we just have to adapt our methods of actually dealing with it. And this has to be a partnership. So it has to be a whole adoption procedure. It has to be adopted by the court system, by the state, by the police departments, and we all have to be in unison and in agreement on how we're going to move forward and actually making sure that we can regulate it, kind of like alcohol.
I was going to say, so will we see, like, for example, Lieutenant Perez, are we going to see kind of the same sort of sobriety tests where people are walking a line or something like that, like you would with alcohol?
I mean, it could possibly be, but understand that marijuana effects are a little bit more different than alcohol. And so what we look for in alcohol might not be the same that we're looking for in marijuana. And this is why I'm saying that there needs to be a unified kind of methodology that we would use in being able to detect and successfully prosecute someone if, in fact, they're under the influence, and let's say they cause an accident or, you know, some type of, you know, crazy event. These are the things that we have to look out for. But I'll tell you, even the Police Foundation, which is an organization that does a lot of studies, empirical studies and things like that, they often even say that that right now there's such a diversity in how we're you know, looking at the law and implementing the law, that there needs to be a standard, just like there is national on DUIs for or DWIs while you know, with alcohol. So I think that's what we have to look for. There is no one thing right now that we can do, but there are different things that we can do, and I think we just need to come up with like a one-stop shop where we can all agree that, you know, someone can be detected with having a high level of marijuana.
Is there like a level, Lieutenant Perez, like, you know, we always hear about, oh, this person blew a whatever. And I understand alcohol and marijuana are two totally different things, obviously. But is there like a level where you're like, whoa, this person has too much in their system, if that makes sense?
Well, no, it totally makes sense. I'm not sure if we even have the tools right now presently to be able to detect exactly how much. Because this is all, you have to understand, this is all pretty new for us, for
sure.
All of us, right?
Sure.
Especially in law enforcement. So first, we went through the decriminalization process, which, you know, clearly it kind of brought a change in the way we kind of, you know, not only looked at marijuana, but how we enforced it. And now, of course, you're talking about, you know, full legalization. So we're kind of like in the 1920s prohibition. Maybe we can look back in history and see how they handled it.
Right. Just go back to our history books, see what they did.
Go back to our history books and let's read up. But really what it comes down to is this. We need to come up collectively, criminal justice as a whole, because there are many different parts, right? As a whole, we need to come up with, you know, ways and methods that we're going to deal with detecting this and successfully prosecuting this.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's a little murky because it's all over the place, right?
Right.
You know, alcohol you can detect right away. I'm not sure if you can... if there are tests out there that can detect marijuana use right away, or if it's after, you know, a day or two or a week or whatever, I don't have no idea. But
right.
But I do know that it's not going to be exactly the same as alcohol, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gotten that down. We have it figured out, but now we have to kind of work, because apparently every state, if you look at the studies, every state is handling it a little bit differently, you know what I mean, and how they're actually enforcing it, detecting it, that kind of stuff. So we need to come up with like just one way or you know, or a similar way of being able to do that. And I think that's where science is going to come in. We're going to depend on labs and things like that to come up with, you know.
What would be like the best approach for how to handle this? And Lieutenant Perez, my last question is, do you suspect we're going to see an uptick in like car crashes or collisions? I know in other states they've said they see anywhere between 5 to 10% uptick once it became legal in their states. So do you suspect the same will happen here?
I do. I think that it's going to be pretty much standard anywhere that legalizes it. I think you'll see like a little peak and then you'll see like a little drop. I think it'll be like in peaks and valleys. That's what I suspect. That's my personal feelings and what I've read from other states and places. I mm-hmm. think that that it's gonna definitely make an impact, not necessarily in a good way when it comes to, you know, the intoxication level, but I could also see it making a less impact in that, you know. You know, you won't have, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but you won't have like that bravado like alcohol. You just think that you can do everything and then go out there and drive and kill an entire family in a car. You know
right,
I mean?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it'll be more docile, a little bit more, whatever. But Listen, time will tell. That's mm-hmm. all we can do. Just wait and see. The best thing we can do is police agencies can prepare ahead of time for it. Mm-hmm. They discuss it. They can look for methods on a state level or on a court level where we can, you know, meet with the district attorneys and then come up with a plan on how we're going to enforce this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's happening now, and it probably has been happening for a while. So, but whether we have something that's like ironclad, sort of like down, like DUI with alcohol, I'm not sure whether yet.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Perez, we certainly know that as soon as that does become more readily available, especially for the public to know, we know that we'll be getting it from you. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too. Hey, good morning, everybody. It is 7:39. So the Department of Health and Human Services launched a program called Operation Expanded Testing. This provides funds for the initial COVID-19 testing surveillance programs for K-12 schools and community organizations across the nation. In fact, Affinity Empowering is working in agreement with, Health and Human Services to implement these testing programs in 26 states, including right here in Connecticut. And joining me this morning, I'm excited to talk to Michael Tacock, who is the Chief Operations Officer of, the Chief Operations Officer of Affinity Empowering. And Michael, thank you for being here this morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So first of all, Michael, I would imagine that especially going into the fall, we still don't technically have a COVID vaccine ready for kids under the age of 12. So I imagine that it's still going to be pretty prevalent to have COVID testing available at our schools, correct?
Yes. The thinking behind it is also when you have communities going through and relaxing a lot of the safety initiatives that have been put in place to curb the spread of the virus, you're going to have kids that are out in the community and then they're going back to school where the ability for the virus to spread, if present, would be fairly quickly. So having surveillance testing and being able to help identify it quickly and then act upon it is going to be very important.
Now, what if we have a school or even like a community leader listening right now? They're not signed up for this program. Is there still time to sign up for it?
Oh, absolutely. And, we're going to be taking people throughout our programs can onboard throughout the entire duration of the program. And so it's something that we definitely want to start the conversation and getting set up early is always a good option. But we're also available to take people and we'll sign up communities and organizations at any point.
So we're talking this morning to Michael Tacock, and he is the Chief Operations Officer of Affinity Empowering. Now, Affinity Empowering, as I mentioned, is working with the Department of Health and Human Services to continue this program called Operation Expanded Testing. It is bringing COVID-19 testing to our schools. So, Michael, do you mind just explaining how does the program work?
Yeah, absolutely. So Department of Health and Human Services initiated and earmarked a bunch of funding to help with the understanding of trying to bring testing to a number of different areas throughout the United States. And so they created Operation Expanded Testing. Now, they're working with Clinical Enterprise or Eurofins, which we're actually conducting the testing on behalf of, so us at Affinity Empowering. And what it is it's a bunch of funding that's used to help expand the availability of testing and also help fully fund it to pay for it for places that might not otherwise be testing or considering testing as a way to help continue to curb the spread of COVID-19. Now, this works in conjunction with a lot of the state funding that's already out there as well. And so while this program pays for testing supplies and the actual testing process, organizations can also still use the state funding that's out there, even provided federally, to help pay for other things that are not covered within this program. For instance, if people wanted to have collectors or anything else paid for by the state, they can do that in conjunction with Operation Expanded Testing.
Now, Michael, I'm curious, once COVID vaccines become available for 6 months and older, I know that doctors here and across the country are suspecting that could happen as early as September. Would you still recommend that schools keep doing COVID testing? And the reason I ask that is because, first of all, I'm sure we're not going to see 100% of kids vaccinated. But the other thing is that the vaccine is not a cure. It's a tool to kind of fight off COVID at this point. So would you still recommend schools do these COVID tests pretty regularly?
Absolutely. And we see this a lot. You can see kind of a similar pattern in the business sector. There are going to be people for various reasons who decide not to get vaccinated. And those that do, there is still uncertainty about different variants and how that can still spread. And as you mentioned, it's not a cure. And so being able to be informed about whether the virus is present, whether it's spreading, and especially thinking about those who are not getting vaccinated and how to help contain that, to protect that, it's going to be important just to keep kind of a hand on the pulse of what's going on with COVID-19.
So, Michael, what happens when a positive case is detected?
Great question. So once a positive case is detected, there is a notification that goes out to both the school and the individual that has been identified positive, or if it's a child, the guardian. And then the school can go ahead and initiate their appropriate protocols on how they handle that, which may include quarantine or testing other individuals who may have had exposure. And that just kind of sets off that cascade. Now, we have staffing 24/7. So we're there as soon as that information comes in. We can go ahead and make sure that notification happens immediately. A lot of that's automated, but we also have that 24/7 support in case there's any other questions to help the individual.
Okay. Now, has Affinity Empowering or even the Department of Health and Human Services, especially as cases are starting to go down, have they gotten any kind of backlash like, hey, we're pushing this too much on schools, or we're overexposing our kids? Or have you guys mostly gotten positive feedback like this is sort of a sigh of relief for parents that this is available at schools?
You know, that's a really good question. There's been a range of responses, and I think it's kind of understandable that some people are getting to a place where they're ready for the pandemic to be over. Mm-hmm. And we're also looking at schools. Schools are a safe place for students to go. And what we're thinking of and how we're really approaching this is that testing isn't something to try to scare people into doing it. It's not something that we say you need to test or else you're in danger, but rather it's another point of awareness. It's a data point. And once you have that data point, you can make accurate decisions and make good choices about what to do next. And so we really look at this as just an opportunity to say, be informed, and then that way you can decide what to do. And when we really put it like that, a lot of people can understand the utility and the benefit of that, because just like you would want, if you had diabetes, you want to measure your insulin levels, you'd also want to see for the health of your school, is COVID present? Do we need to do something about it? If not, that is also a data point.
Mm-hmm. Talking this morning to Michael Tkach, who is the Chief Operations Officer of Affinity Empowering, which is partnering with the Department of Health and Human Services to bring COVID-19 testing to schools across our country, as well as here in Connecticut. Is there a website or anything, Michael, if someone's interested in getting more information about this?
Absolutely. safercommunities.affinitytesting.com. And if you go there it gives you a lot of information about the program, as well as ways for organizations and schools to sign up.
Michael Tkach, thank you so much for coming on this morning. I appreciate it. So I found a new study showing that a few big differences between baby boomer marriages versus millennial marriages. One of the key elements is that we move in together too soon. And another thing that I have noticed is that there tends to be a trend with younger marriages that people will treat their friends a whole lot nicer than they actually treat their spouses. And to talk a little bit about this morning is our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan. So I think the big question to start off with, Bob, is why do we treat our friends better than our spouses a lot of times?
Yeah, morning. It's a weird dynamic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've observed that. I certainly have with couples that in social settings, they're just the nicest, polite. They can be respectful and everything, and then in a whole different dynamic in their marriage, they just turn in a whole different set of behavior. So it's just weird, right? So I was thinking about this last week. I was thinking about this topic. So I looked, trying to get into this, and a couple of key things I found, and they're understandable, one of which is that because you get up every morning next to this person and you go through your routine, like, you get complacent.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get complacent, right? I think you take each other for granted. You're like, you know, Derek's going to be there when you get home today. You know, he's going to get up tomorrow. Like, Karen's going to do her thing. Like, I think over time, we get lazy. We lack intention of growing and investing in our marriage relationship. And I think we take each other for granted. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big reason.
I mean, and I would think that kind of goes hand in hand with not really appreciating your spouse either, Bob.
Yeah, it kind of leads into that. If you can picture this, like that's almost like a leading indicator. The lagging indicator, the next thing that would be, is that you stop appreciating. And I think, you know, you have a young son. Well, I had three kids pretty much close together, so it's hard, right?
Yeah,
it's
to separate.
Hard, like, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, to work and everything. So I think when things are hard and you're managing a house and you take these other for granted, I think you stop appreciating the little things and other big things. I think couples generally do a big job in the when they step out. It's the little daily things that we start lacking to say thank you. So I think another reason is, you know, there is definitely an aspect of image management to our friends. When you're with your friends, when
you're your best self.
You're kind of on your best behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. You're filtered.
Exactly. You filter. Good word. You put your mask on, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you come into your house, the mask comes off, the filter comes off, you're real. So, mm-hmm. you know, that your spouse sees kind of the real you, your friends see kind of this image you. So, so those are some reasons why. And also the last one I'll just mention is I think we expect way too much from our spouse at times. You know, many of us have been through not ideal growing up experiences, and you bring that into the marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think whether it's childhood trauma or some abuse, I think not dealing with that, we tend to expect our spouse to fill some gaps that we haven't. So, you know, I think those are kind of three or four reasons why that might be true.
I mean, I think it's also pretty common, Bob Donovan, who's our marriage consultant on the show, that we almost expect them to be mind readers. I still am guilty of this from time to time, where I expect if I roll over and I'm upset and I just stop talking, you know, I expect Derek to know that, okay, clearly I want to talk more about this, but a lot of times he'll just exit the room. And I think to myself, wait, really? But if I didn't say it out loud, or I don't really spell out like, hey, this is how I'm feeling, we should be talking about this. You know, I think a lot of times we put that on our spouses where we're like, all right, you should know me by now. But it's like, well, listen, you also got to tell me how you're feeling. I'm not a mind reader. I'm not a fortune teller.
Yeah, generally that's very true. I think we I don't want to generalize it, but a lot of men aren't good at this. So even when you say something about something that's bothering you, men don't know how to react to that generally pretty well. I mean, we tend to think that we're trying to figure out what's going on.
We're fixers,
we're fixers, right? You know that, right? And when you say something's bothering you, we either think, what did I do to cause that, or how can I fix this, rather than just validating, wow, you're hurting on this, or you're frustrating. So we don't handle things like that well either in the marriage.
We're talking to Bob Donovan this morning, trying to get advice on how to strengthen our relationships and our marriages. And one of the biggest things is that a lot of times we'll treat even like the waiter at a restaurant nicer than our spouse as soon as they walk away. So how do you fix the way you treat your spouse, Bob? If you're finding that you've been either in a short-term marriage or you're in a long-term, you've been with this person for 50 years, how do you start to rebuild that respect and that friendship really between you and your spouse to sort of get to that level again?
Yeah, well, you kind of landed on a key aspect, and that's really, number one, is to ask yourself, do I do this? I mean, do I do this? Do I treat, as you said, the waiter, my friends, my coworkers, better than I treat my spouse? Do you do this? So one would be to take ownership for you. Take ownership for your behavior, for actions. The thing that might happen is you kind of think about what, you know, what they should be doing. So one would be just take ownership for you and what you can do in your marriage. And again, acknowledge that you might be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing you said, I didn't think about this, but it's true. Start treating your spouse like your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Like we did. Most couples became friends first.
Right.
So kind of go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. I mean, the second way we talked earlier just would be to stop taking them for granted and stop building in appreciation for what they do. And even if it's the little things, like going to work every day, like just getting up, going to work every single day. Just thank your wife or your husband for doing that,
mm-hmm.
making meals. Like, you know, I really thank Karen for all she does around the house. Like, I come home and sometimes, like, she'll have my underwear folded on the bed. And I thank her for that. Like,
right.
I really do.
Right,
I really do, so.
No, you know? It's true. It's true. It's recognizing those things. It's sometimes checking your ego at the door and not, you know, saying, oh, well, I did six things and you did two today. So until I get a thank you, you're not going to hear from me. Like it's a two-way street. And to be able to do that and to get rid of the complacency and to turn that more into intentions, like you had mentioned, Bob, I think these are all like really simple things. They sound really simple, but a lot of times we're so stuck in our ways or we're stuck in who we've been our entire lives that when you enter a partnership, it's hard to make that adjustment. So if someone's struggling with this and they want your help in how to sort of navigate, how do they contact you?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to dialogue and figure this out with people. So yeah, it would be email would be great. And best would be B. Donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N @blackrock.org.
Bob, I love having you on. Thank you so much.
Hey, one quickie. You know that this is our 1 year anniversary, by the way.
Of you being on the show?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah,
my gosh, Bob. Look at you. So much intention there. Look at you. Thank you. Oh my gosh. Well, happy anniversary to you being on WICC. You've been a very valued part of this show. We love having you on, Bob. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Melissa. Bye-bye.
Wow. What a cool little milestone. I love that.